For decades, Elizabeth Elliot has influenced many people through her books, timeless teaching, and courageous faith. She shares with us what she's learned as a daughter, wife, mother, and missionary on this radio program, Gateway to Joy. Let's join Elizabeth now as she encourages us once again to live life to its fullest as disciples of Jesus Christ.
Jesus said, "If anyone loves me, he will obey my teaching. My Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him." This is your friend, Elizabeth Elliot, talking again today about some lessons learned from the life of Francis Ridley Havergal. The supernatural life should be the shaping principle of our lives, your life and my life. Do you maintain a constant attitude of lifting up your heart to God? It's a wonderful way to outgrow the limits of our earthliness and to fit ourselves wholeheartedly for and into God's world. When I read the life of this woman, I can see that the supernatural was the shaping principle of her life. There was a sense in which, in her very short 43 years, you can see how she was continually outgrowing the limits of earthliness and being fitted daily for the life of God, for and into God's world. The Bible tells us that we're to seek those things which are above. And I was reading part of a letter that Francis Ridley Havergal had written to a student in my last program, and she goes on in another letter to this same student. He was apparently home for vacation or something, and she had written urging him to come to Jesus, and she writes now, "I know you must have thought me very hard upon you on Friday morning, but what could I do? I see you, a young, fresh life, redeemed by the precious blood of Christ, believing and owning what he has done for you with grand possibilities of power in his cause, and I think endowed with special gifts of influence and attraction, one who might be and do so much for Jesus. And yet, Jesus does not come first in your life, and you know it might be otherwise and ought to be otherwise. You are entangled when you might be free in his glorious liberty. You are unsatisfied, yes, and dissatisfied, and you might be abundantly satisfied. He has dealt bountifully with you, and now what shall you render to him? Has not the practical answer been just as much as I can conveniently spare, after I have rendered all that society asks and that self or personal enjoyment claims? Just as much as I can spare him with risk of the least awkwardness or remark or self-denial. Of course, one must give up the bulk of one's time and talents and influence and thoughts and desires and efforts to other things, but he shall have just the chips and shavings, the odds and ends of whatever I don't particularly want for myself or for anybody else. Does it not practically amount to just this? And shall it continue to do so? Oh, to be true-hearted and whole-hearted, be really his faithful soldier and servant. Throw overboard forever the divided allegiance, which is valueless." Well, I hope that there may be some who listened to that and realized that their attitude was like that student's. I'll give him the chips and the shavings of my life. Don't you want the supernatural to be the shaping principle? Well, Frances Ridley Havergal was a holy woman, she was a godly woman, she was a Christian woman, she was a great example. And I want you to know that she was very concerned with a whole lot of very earthly, down-to-earth things. And so I want to read some passages which will help you to see that that supernatural principle shaped everything. She talks about money, how she spends money. She wrote a hymn which is probably most familiar to us of all the hymns that she wrote, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee." And one stanza, which has been omitted from a good many hymn books, and I think I know why, says, "Take my silver and my gold, not a mite would I withhold. How do you feel about your money? Is it yours or is it God's? Well, but some have been disturbed by that stanza in the hymn, and so I wanted to be sure to read you her explanation of what she meant. She said that stanza is peculiarly liable to be objected to by those who do not really understand the spirit of it. I'm not a bit surprised. Yes, not a mite would I withhold. But that does not mean because we have 10 shillings in our purse, we are pledged to put it all into the next collecting plate, else we should have none for the next call. But it does mean that every shilling is to be, and I think I may say is, held at my Lord's disposal, and is distinctly not my own. But as he has entrusted to me a body for my special charge, I am bound to clothe that body with his silver and gold, so that it shall neither suffer from cold nor bring discredit upon his cause. I still forget sometimes, but as a rule, I never spend a sixpence without the distinct feeling that it is his and must be spent for him only, even if indirectly. And then with the same kind of common sense, she explains her reasons for dressing very nicely. The outer should be the expression of the inner, not an ugly mask or disguise. If the king's daughter is to be all glorious within, and she's quoting there a verse from the Psalms, she must not be outwardly a fright. I must dress both as a lady and a Christian. The question of cost I see very strongly and do not consider myself at liberty to spend on dress that which might be spared for God's work. But it costs no more to have a thing well and prettily made, and I should only feel justified in getting a costly dress if it would last proportionately longer. And of course, this was written more than 100 years ago, and it does indeed cost more to have a thing well made nowadays. It's pretty hard, even in a high-priced dress, to find something well made. So I think we do need to do a lot of praying and serious considering before we spend money. Let's go back to Francis Ridley Havergal. When working among strangers, if I dressed below par, it would attract attention and might excite opposition. By dressing unremarkably and yet with a generally pleasing effect, no attention is distracted. Also, what is suitable in one house is not so in another, and it would be almost an insult to appear at dinner among some of my relatives and friends in what I could wear without apology at home. It would be an actual breach of the rule, be courteous. Also, I should not think it right to appear among wedding guests in a dress which would be perfectly suitable for wearing to the hospital. But I shall always ask for guidance in all things. And I think her principle given there is particularly important. Be courteous. Have you ever thought of your dress having anything to do with courtesy? If a speaker gets up on a platform looking like a slob, if a musician gets up on a platform looking like a wild man, is that Christian courtesy? Ought we not to consider the effect that our looks have on other people? Well, in addition to those very practical matters, I want to read you some bits about her love of exercise and of the outdoors. Her sister Miriam writes, "Early in October, Frances joined me in our Welsh retreat. How I remember her first words to me, 'I wanted so to get to you, Marie dear.' She was so very tired that even the fresh sea air and perfect rest failed to refresh her for some time. Afterwards, she thoroughly enjoyed the walks and scrambles over the cliffs, at low tide springing lightly over boulders to beds of seaweeds and rocky pools bright with sea anemones, and then calling to me to watch the white-crested waves, the wind dashing them back like confirmation veils, or watching the vessels with all sails up entering the harbor. She would speak of the abundant entrance into the everlasting kingdom. Delighting in all knowledge, she studied the nautical almanac, and at the top of the Mumbles Lighthouse learnt all that the keeper could tell her. Her tastes were so simple, delighting in wildflowers and in animals, from the great St. Bernard dogs to her pet kittens. She tells about her library. Her small but choice library showed the variety of her taste, classical, foreign, poetical, with many works on science, geology, etc. Humboldt's and Professor Ritchie's works, his last gift, she much enjoyed, when the scant leisure time came. The last books she had in reading were The Earth's Formation on Dynamical Principles by T. Ritchie, Goodwin's works, The Life and Letters of the Reverend W. Pennefather, of which she said, "I find such food in that book." Do you read books that feed you junk food or nourishing food? And then, what time did she get up? Was her life an ordered one? Her sister says, "May I sketch her at her study table in her favorite chair?" Older than herself. Her American typewriter was close by so that she could turn to it from her desk. It was a great relief to her eyes, but its rapid working often told me that she was busy when she should have rested. Her desk and table drawers were all methodically arranged for letters from editors, friends, relatives, strangers, matters of business, multitudinous requests, Irish society work, manuscripts, paper and string in their allotted corners, no litter ever allowed. It was at her study table that she read her Bible by 7 o'clock in the summer and 8 o'clock in winter, her Hebrew Bible, Greek Testament, and lexicons being at hand. Sometimes on bitterly cold mornings, I begged that she would read with her feet comfortably to the fire and received the reply, "But then, Marie, I can't rule my lines neatly. Just see what a find I've got. If only one searches, there are such extraordinary things in the Bible." And this biography includes a facsimile of a page from her Bible showing the very, very neat way in which she wrote marginal notes and drew lines that indicated connections between verses.
You've been listening to Gateway to Joy with Elizabeth Elliott, author of over 20 books, including Discipline, The Glad Surrender, and No Graven Image. Join us next time for more encouragement and challenge from Elizabeth Elliott. This has been a production of the Bible Broadcasting Network. Mm-hmm.